and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm executive director at American Compass, and we are coming to you today for a special Earth Day episode with Thomas Hockman, research associate at the Foundation for American Innovation. You can find his work at American Affairs, at the New Atlantis, a lot of interesting places. Thomas, really appreciate you joining us for this discussion.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
As you know, under the Inflation Reduction Act, every 501c3 is required to have an Earth Day podcast. So we are just doing our part, but had been wanting to speak to you for a while about a bunch of energy and environment policy topics. I think this is a really interesting area for the new right where, frankly, people don't do as much work, in part because there's not that much disagreement with the old right. I think everybody, generally speaking, is in favor of all of the above energy policy, and so far as that means as much abundant, cheap energy as possible. Everybody's interested in permitting reform. Everybody sees, you know, energy as a part of the industrial economy as really important. And, you know, one interesting place I want to get into a little is the question around climate, and whereas the old right historically struggled with the climate question and whether climate change was even happened. It does seem like folks are settling a little bit more now into a perspective of acknowledging that the climate is in fact changing, but noting that probably does not mean the Earth will not be habitable, in Bernie Sanders' words, and also noting that doesn't mean that this or that, you know, wind turbine is likely to solve the problem. So, you know, you're phenomenal on the details of so much of this and really getting into the technical side of it. Would love to start with a broader question, just where you see as the low-hanging fruit. What would you love to hear conservatives, folks on the new right, talking about more when we're talking about energy and environmental policy?
Sure, yeah. So I think as it relates to conservatives' position on climate change broadly, I'm kind of two minds around where we actually are on this. I think on the one hand, the average Republican voter probably generally believes in climate change and anthropogenic climate change. But I also think that if you were to ask the average backbencher in Congress whether or not the science is settled, so to speak, they would probably be dubious. And I think a lot of Republican candidates in this cycle are also dubious. But I think regardless of where Republicans are on climate change itself, there are still a number of solutions that will be good for the climate, but also good more broadly and good as part of a broader Republican policy agenda. So I think a great example of this is permitting reform, right? You know, cutting red tape has been something that every Republican politician talks about during the campaign cycle and would be good for energy and infrastructure in general. So, you know, we know, you know, Democrats have woken up to the fact that a law like NEPA, an environmental law, actually holds up clean energy infrastructure more than it holds up any other type of energy source. But really a law like NEPA, to use that example, blocks infrastructure of all sorts, right? It blocks everything from clean energy to congestion pricing plans in cities. In one great example, it slowed down the development of a plan for wildfire prevention. And by the time that it was finished, the forest in question had been burned down due to a wildfire, right? So it's this really expansive law. And I think Republicans are aware of the fact that these laws are bad for really, you know, infrastructure, for climate, for building things here in the U.S. And so that seems like, particularly over the next few years, the lowest of the fruit to pick.
I've always loved the permitting and NEPA and so forth issues. They seem like such obvious ones. And to your point, they seem like something that even the progressive left, even environmentalists, if they were behaving rationally, would want to fix as well. And yet we don't seem to fix them. It seems like, you know, in part, it seems like still a partisan issue. In part, you know, I think you had sort of Republicans standing in the way of NEPA reform in the CHIPS Act context because they didn't like the way that issue was cutting. Why isn't this one of these things that has gotten solved a long time ago?
Yeah, I think there's two key components here. I think the first is that on the left, there's a divergence between environmentalists of the old school variety, which are really conservationists and groups like the Sierra Club and the NRDC, and climate hawks. Because environmentalists, groups like the Sierra Club will often sue to block clean energy projects. They'll use NEPA as a way to block various infrastructure projects from moving forward because they're concerned about local environmental concerns. And so they'll sue on the basis of, look, this energy project didn't describe how their project was going to impact the sage grouse population in the area, right? Versus the climate hawks who are saying, look, we want to build out as much solar and wind potential as we possibly can. And so there's a split within the Democratic Party, which I think still needs to be resolved. But I think, you know, more broadly, the strange thing about NEPA reform is that the left thinks that it's something that the right wants, and the right thinks that it's something that the left wants. And so when it comes to negotiations, the right and the left always ask for an additional thing. So right now, for example, Manchin and Barrasso are in talks to come forward with this broad permitting reform package. But Manchin and the Democrats view NEPA reform as something that the right wants. So they're asking for something around transmission siting. And the right says, well, no, you want NEPA reform so that you can get clean energy built out faster. So we want to open up more natural gas permits. And in the end, nobody gets anything because each one sees themselves as getting the short end of the stick in negotiations.
Is there a way of skinning this that thinks more broadly about environmental policy as well? Because, you know, I know you've written about it's not just NEPA. You've got the Clean Air Act, you've got the Clean Water Act, you've got all of these other sort of hoops that you have to jump through, all of which that were well-intentioned and when passed in the 1970s, in fact, produced incredible gains in terms of environmental quality. Today, we're obviously in a very different place. How would you rate that relative to the NEPA issues in terms of what needs to be the priority and maybe also where there's any chance of progress?
Right. Well, I think we're likely to get worked on NEPA first. And I think it's important to understand the difference between the way that NEPA works and the way that the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act works. So NEPA is procedural law, whereas the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, for the most part, are more substantive. So what NEPA says is, in short, you need to describe what the environmental impacts of your project are going to be. But it doesn't say you need to keep your environmental impacts below this standard or you need to meet this metric. It just says you need to describe what your impacts are going to be.
Right. So you could say this project is going to totally wreck the environment and pollute the air. And as long as that's accurate, you've met the requirements of NEPA.
Pretty much. And I mean, what we find with NEPA is that, you know, the main thing that a project has to undergo when they go through NEPA is an environmental assessment. And the environmental assessment is really just saying, okay, what do we actually need to do next under NEPA? And so after the environmental assessment, you either get a FONSI, which is a finding of no significant impact, which means that you can move forward, or you have to go through an EIS, an environmental impact statement, which is a much broader set of paperwork, basically. But more than 99% of projects that go through NEPA end up with a FONSI, which means that you've gone through years and years of paperwork, expended a huge amount of money to find that your project will not have a significant impact on the environment. And that's it. Nothing actually happens. Nothing substantively as it relates to the environment happens. Whereas with the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, actually there is something substantive happening. It's a commitment to staying below a certain air quality standard, for example, to use the Clean Air Act. And so somebody like me who thinks a lot about the Clean Air Act and NEPA looks at NEPA and says, look, this law is actually doing almost nothing to help the environment, if anything at all. Whereas the Clean Air Act is clearly doing something, right? Pollution is something material. The Clean Air Act clearly limits pollution. It clearly saves a lot of lives every single year. And so when we think about the Clean Air Act, look, the Clean Air Act definitely has problems, and I talk about them a lot, but it would not be good for America if we got rid of the Clean Air Act. I think it would be good for America if we got rid of NEPA.
And so, well, this is my proposal is why don't we just, you know, instead of all this permitting reform, why don't we just get rid of NEPA? It seems to literally do more harm than good. But, and to your point, the Clean Air Act might need reform, but you still want a Clean Air Act. If you were sort of thinking about, okay, here, you know, here is where conservatives should be, therefore, on environmental policy, how would you describe kind of at the top line level what the framework should be? Obviously, you know, protecting the environment is both still very important to conservatives as well and very politically popular. The kind of let's just not care about the environment is a non-starter. But it does seem that conservatives struggle to communicate a sort of positive and constructive message on this instead of just sort of resisting whatever the other side is saying. what would you ideally want to hear them saying?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about recently is this whole idea of the abundance agenda, which has come out of the left of center. But yet, you know, it's strange because the actual policy suite that the abundance agenda folks advocate for seems like it comes out of the right. It's slash red tape. It's build things, right? Make it easier to build things. Make it easier to build things here in America. And so things like making it easier to build infrastructure of all sorts, making it easier to balance environmental and economic incentives, seem like the sort of thing that the right should get on board with. And not only that, but I actually think the right has a huge opportunity here to take advantage of this energy behind the abundance agenda, because while the left of center advocates for it, I think a lot of the Democratic coalition doesn't actually want it in practice. And I think they're going to have serious difficulties converting that energy into real policy change. But the right wing is actually pretty happy to talk about deregulation. And they're pretty happy to talk about making it easier to build all sorts of energy and to be neutral about the types of energy sources that we pursue, for example. And so something like the abundance agenda, but actually, you know, paired with the ability to convert that into real practice is something that I think that the right should be excited about. And also it's an optimistic message, right? It's not just being against something, it's being for something and something pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's right. The actual abundance agenda, because as you point out,
it
is something that has come out of a group of folks who would identify themselves with the left, but it's not clear that they actually have any home on the left with this agenda as they're running into quite explicitly. And it really aligns a lot better with the sort of message that you'd want to hear coming from the right. And with a lot of other things that the right is talking about, whether it's, you know, reshoring an industrial policy, whether it's, you know, labor reform. I mean, the full suite of things that sort of gets America building again, in a sense, has a strong environmental component. I wanted to dig in on one of my sort of personal hobby horses within this space, which is nuclear. And nuclear just strikes me as just an amazing issue, just in general for any rational person, but particularly given the political lineup these days for a conservative agenda. And so I'll sort of briefly make the case. You can throw some cold water on my enthusiasm wherever you want, or expand as you see fit. You know, it seems to me the basic case for nuclear is, on one hand, it has extraordinary potential that's just never really fully been tapped. That because of environmental and regulatory policy in particular, we sort of stalled out the progress that might have been made. And so there's an incredible amount of, if not low-hanging fruit, at least sort of room to run in improving on nuclear technology, in making it a very plausible way to generate massive, massive amounts of very reliable, very clean energy. So that, you know, for one thing, that is in and of itself a good. For a second thing, if you had that, the advantages it would provide to the rest of the economy in terms of, you know, the advantages our industrial economy would have over countries that don't have that kind of cheap marginal energy would be massive. So that's a second benefit. A third is that the nuclear industry itself would be potentially a massive source of you know, growth and job creation domestically, but also be an incredible opportunity for global leadership. Because if you were doing this stuff right, it's exactly the sort of thing the rest of the world would want from the United States, and we could plausibly have an advantage in. And then fourth, this is a little bit more esoteric, but something I really like about it. It is tailor-made for subsidy and industrial policy. And what I mean by that is that all of the costs are so front-loaded that it's a place where if government wants to actually make significant investments, it's not like you necessarily have to commit to permanently subsidizing some industry year after year on an operating basis. If you agree, you know, sort of more in infrastructure terms, to think about nuclear infrastructure as something the public wants to invest in, you can spend that money in a very sort of coherent, controlled way. And then the benefits just pay out over decades because the capital costs are up front and the actual operating costs and the marginal cost of the electricity you're generating are then just extraordinarily low. And so it seems to me to line up especially well with the kind of policy we should want to be doing if we want public investment in a way that actually then fosters the private market and private investment. So that's my pitch for the nuclear industry, but pick any piece of that to elaborate on or tell me what's most wrong with it.
No, I think I basically agree, but I think the challenge is nuclear is incredibly expensive, no matter how you slice it. The upfront costs are enormous. And so I think the key challenge here is one of political economy, and particularly on the right, like, you know, rhetorically, conservatives tend to be pretty pro-nuclear. But the thing about nuclear is that it's probably the least free market energy source that you could drum up, right? It's incredibly expensive. It's highly regulated. It tends to have a lot of state involvement. And, you know, perhaps the biggest problem with nuclear and one that I'm happy to dig into more is this whole issue of the negative learning curve. So when you build nuclear, you have an issue which runs contrary to what happens with basically every other energy source, which is when you build more nuclear plants, the next plant tends to be more expensive than the last one. With something like solar, right, the price of solar has dropped by more than 99% over the last 30 years because of this positive learning curve. The more you build, the cheaper it gets. But with nuclear, we've seen the opposite effect. And that's not just the case in the US. This is the other problem. Is it's not as simple as, look, if we can reform the NRC to make it easier to build nuclear here in the US, we won't see this problem anymore. If we can get environmentalist groups who are suing to stop nuclear from moving forward, we won't see this problem anymore. In France, which has been cited as the best case of a nuclear scale-up anywhere, they still saw negative learning. And in France, look, they pushed it down through the entire plan through one nationalized electric utility. They managed to keep complete standardization across their models, the sort of thing that you could just never really imagine happening in the United States. And I mentioned that because standardization has been floated as one of the key ways to clamp down on that negative learning. And so, you know, I think that the challenge here is how do we move beyond thinking about energy just on a cost basis or just on an initial cost basis? Because clearly, has a lot of value that goes beyond just how expensive is it? You know, what is the levelized cost of energy? It's also, is it clean? Is it nationally secure, right? Because natural gas, for example, is really, really cheap right now. But at the same time, you know, with oil and gas, they're globally traded commodities. So the US can be a huge producer of oil and gas, but Russia invades Ukraine and all of a sudden Americans are paying more at the pump. So there's clearly a national security component. There's a reliability component. Solar's super cheap, but it's not reliable in the way that a firm power source like nuclear is. So clearly there's huge value. And I totally agree that really what we need is the sort of thing that you advocate for, which is a conservative embrace of that type of thinking, right? Industrial policy thinking about upfront subsidies, because indeed capital costs are the major barrier here to building out nuclear. But I wonder, are we there politically?
Yeah, so the political question is obviously incredibly important. I want to dig a little further into the negative learning point, though, which is such a fascinating one. You know, I don't doubt empirically that it's true. I'm very curious what the rationale for it being true is. To your point, we see this almost nowhere. Why would it get harder and more expensive? Well, let me caveat. Where you do see this, of course, and this is the implication of upward sloping supply curves generally, is that, you know, if you're planting corn and you plant all the best acres first and you start going out onto marginal acres, your yield is going to decline. That's fair enough. If you had a limited number of good sites for nuclear plants and you use the best sites first, you'd end up then moving into worse sites and it might get more expensive. But it doesn't seem like that's what's happening. Why on earth would it get more expensive? Why would we get worse at nuclear the more we build?
Yeah, I mean, I wish there was a good monocausal answer to this, but I really don't think that there is. I want to shout out two papers on this, which I think do a good job of breaking it down. One of them is an article by Brian Potter at Institute for Progress, and another one is by this guy, Arnulf Grubler. I've seen a couple different theses. So, you know, one is that it's really all this negative learning is a result of the construction process. And that a lot of this is that just the cost of hiring technicians and nuclear engineers has gone up much more quickly than the, you know, the total value of the nuclear plant or, you know, other components of the nuclear scale up. And I think that that certainly makes sense, that 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 has to be part of it. And I, and the solution there is also, in the US, we're not in the constant state of building nuclear plants. And so our skill supply chain for nuclear is constantly atrophying. And then whenever we want to build a new nuclear plant, all of a sudden we need to scale that back up again. And it takes a long time, and it's challenging. I was talking to somebody about this recently, and he described nuclear plants as cathedrals. And I think that's that's about right. It's that is the scale and complexity of projects like this. And so when you have, you know, entire pieces of the skill supply chain that you need to build back up again out of almost nothing, that's obviously incredibly expensive. I've also heard people float that part of this is just the complexity of managing the fuel cycle. In the US, there's the additional challenge of, as we've tried to build nuclear, our regulations have constantly changed. So there's a ton of uncertainty. The regulations get more stringent over time. So clearly that's something that that you could get at. But really, I think, you know, my feeling is that I haven't seen one great answer to why there's been negative learning everywhere and not just in the US. It does seem like part of this is just the inherent complexity. And it seems like part of it is just how long it takes to build these plants, right? These are, you know, these are 10, 12 year projects. In the US, right, the most recent nuclear plant to come online, Vogtle, was even more than that.
Cathedral analogy is really interesting because the other place you hear it is in chip fabrication, like as the sort of, you know, most sophisticated epitomes of modern technology and engineering achievement. And that, of course, is the other place where the U.S. is currently stepping in right now and trying to regain lost capacity. I guess the difference in nuclear, we did used to be the world leaders in technology, but it never really at scale. I mean, you mentioned France as the one place that's really kind of built at scale as the core of an energy system. I guess one other technical question is just, is there new stuff on the horizon, you know, not getting into fusion versus fission, and, you know, but there's always been a lot of talk about alternative designs, small modular reactors. Is that, in your sense, you know, mostly just kind of hand waving and navel gazing, or is there also an element here where if we didn't just start building new plants right away, but actually made a real effort over a decade to figure out what the next generation of plants should be, we might come up with really new and better answers?
Yeah, I mean, this is another hotly contested question, and I'm sure some people will disagree with me, but if I were to guess, I would say we're probably going to, and if we do build a lot of nuclear in the next 20 to 30 years, it's probably going to be the conventional Westinghouse AP1000 type design, the larger nuclear reactors and not the small modular reactors. We recently, the New Scale project, which was the U.S. small modular reactor project that was closest to completion, recently went under in Utah, or it was in Idaho, actually. It was pretty much a disaster. The federal government put up billions and billions of dollars to try to push it through, and ultimately it failed just because the cost estimate had risen so much that ratepayers were no longer willing to pay that much for electricity. China recently connected the first small modular reactor, and it likewise went way over the cost estimate, took way longer than they expected. And I think more broadly, the emphasis right now in definitely US energy policy, and I think really energy policy more broadly, is we have a lot of proven technologies. And our biggest challenge right now is just building them at scale, deploying them. And I think that's probably true with nuclear as well. The other thing I would add is that small modular reactors, they have the benefit of being standardized. So in some ways, there's a hope that they could beat the whole learning curve problem. But at the same time, they're fighting economies of scale. So there are inherent economic issues there as well. So I would guess that we're probably going to keep building more conventional reactors than we will be building small modular reactors, but we'll see.
So to your point that we have the proved technologies, it's a question of building them, that goes back then to the political question, that one can mean many things when one says the obstacle is political. What are the top political obstacles to really pushing down this road?
Yeah, well, so I think on the right, it's being able to get behind an industrial policy push to subsidize a lot of nuclear plants and to put up a lot of money at the front end to get these nuclear plants built. I think within the federal bureaucracy, it's making sure that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is adequately balancing its goals to both ensure nuclear safety and also get nuclear plants built, right? Because historically, in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they figured that, look, the easiest way to ensure nuclear safety is to never let a single nuclear plant gets built. And that's certainly a strategy, right? But it's probably not a good one for America. So that's obviously crucial. And I think that's probably moving in the right direction. You know, one or two nuclear NRC commissioners ago, the commissioner was a guy who literally said, we should never build nuclear here in America, which is not great. And then on the left, yeah, you do have environmental groups who still institutionally are opposed to nuclear. The Sierra Club, right, says very openly, nuclear is no solution to climate change. And there are many other environmental groups, lefty environmental groups, who are aligned with them. I think sometimes that their role in slowing the nuclear build-out in the U.S. is somewhat overstated, but nevertheless, it's important to still think about them as an influential coalition.
And on that safety point, then, one thing the pro-nuclear folks always emphasize is, you know, basically choose whatever statistic or measure or methodology you want, nuclear is basically the safest energy technology ever. Is, maybe it's a silly question when you're like, well, you're talking about nuclear, but like, what is everybody so afraid of to ask the question in a pedantic way, maybe? Why is it just a psychological thing? Why is this so unlike everything else in our ability to make progress relative to what the data actually suggests?
I think basically, yes, I think it is mostly psychological, right? I mean, people are going to pay more attention to an energy source that has the potential for catastrophic meltdown, right? And again, it seems to be incredibly, incredibly unlikely, right? And again, statistics show that it's incredibly safe. The fact that nuclear is nuclear means that people are going to pay attention to it, right? Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, they all kind of, they're in our collective conscious as things that have happened. And it just doesn't really compare to, you know, I think nuclear has the death per megawatt rate of, you know, wind turbines or something. And it just, people just tend to pay less attention to, you know, somebody who had a wind turbine fall on them or something, right? Because it's just not going to be the same as the implications of a nuclear meltdown. Yeah, beyond that, I think it's hard to understand what the collective concern is, but I think that's the main piece.
Yeah, and so if we were putting this in terms of sort of an agenda for the right and thinking about really what the concerns are on the right, how to overcome those, how to fit it into an abundance agenda, do you think an industrial? I mean, one approach that the right has had in the past on this is just the deregulatory view. Just we have to reform the NRC, we have to cut the red tape. Maybe make government take the regulatory risk and then basically assert that nuclear would become economical or, you know, this would spur the necessary innovation. And then there's the other model, which just says, at least in the short run, that's probably not enough. You probably need a lot of, at a minimum, sort of subsidized investment in building the first round of them, maybe other tools I'm not thinking of. What would you want that package to look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be the latter of those two options. The projects that have become successful in the U.S. and elsewhere in the West over the last decade have been $10+ billion projects. You can't do that with a get the government out of the way, just deregulate approach. That clearly doesn't work. With that said, obviously, those conservative policy proposals around deregulating, making sure that the NRC actually wants to help nuclear projects get built, that you don't have unnecessarily duplicative or stringent NRC rules, clearly will be super helpful in advancing the cause of nuclear, but they won't be enough on their own.
And if I guess the last thing that we started with this a little bit was on the climate question. I mean, it's always so strange to me anyway that this is not considered a climate solution. Is it a fairly comprehensive climate solution? Obviously you have to, if you're cheap electricity isn't enough unless you can then use that electricity in transportation and so forth. So there's always the storage side of it as well. But by and large, is this sort of would it play a keystone role in a coherent climate policy? Or is it like actually there's an awful lot of things it doesn't solve?
Well, I think it can do a lot. I think it can be a crucial part of the, you know, if you had a completely clean energy mix, nuclear would certainly, it has to play a large role if that's what you're looking for, right? Because we know that renewables without storage or without firm power to go along with it can't power the entirety of the energy grid. So you would want firm, clean power like nuclear to be, you know, 40 to 60%, let's say, of that mix. So yeah, nuclear has to be. Do we want nuclear to be responsible for producing 100% of America's electricity? No, because that means that ratepayers will pay way more than they would be if you had solar, right, for example. But yeah, certainly. I mean, nuclear is clean. It's reliable. It'll have huge benefits. And so, yeah, it clearly is a crucial climate solution. I will say, I think that people are coming around to nuclear and its climate benefits, right? I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act, for example, had a lot of money for nuclear. The Department of Energy's Loan Programs Office puts a ton of money behind nuclear projects. But it is still surprising that it hasn't enjoyed a more positive political economy over the last decade in particular.
Yeah, sometimes I do wonder if we were to add up the amount we've spent on some of these energy technologies and had spent it on nuclear, what could you buy with that? I mean,
yeah,
probably not enough, but probably an awful lot. Well, tell us what else are you working on? Something else we should all be thinking about these days.
Well, I mean, this is a bit of a pivot, but one thing that's interesting is thinking about how we fund industrial policy. So, you know, if you look at, for example, Biden's three major climate packages or major industrial policy packages, you have the Inflation Reduction Act, you have the IIJA, which is the Infrastructure Act, you have CHIPS. And one thing that's interesting about this is that there's really two main funding mechanisms that Biden's used. It's tax credits and it's grants. The thing about tax credits, or I guess I should say the problem with grants, is that they take a really long time to roll out. Oftentimes, there's a lot of red tape, so to speak, around actually awarding that money. But the issue with tax credits is that they're protected by IRS confidentiality, which means if, on the one hand, you want to be doing China competition and industrial policy with a bill like CHIPS and investing in American industry, but then on the other hand, you have the Inflation Reduction Act, which is relying on tax credits, and you don't know where any of that money is going, including to Chinese firms and their subsidiaries, that's a huge problem. Because you have two competing philosophies and really two competing mechanisms of industrial policy. And so I think, you know, one thing that I guess I would hope for moving forward, particularly in Republican administrations, is thinking about, look, how are we actually forming a cohesive view of how we do industrial policy, not just, you know, is industrial policy good? Because if you opt for tax credits, you need to be open about the fact that, hey, we actually just don't know where a lot of this money is going. And that includes potentially going to our adversaries. So anyway, that's something I've been thinking a lot about recently.
No, that's a fascinating point that, you know, tax credits sort of, they exist in negative space. They are taxes not paid, particularly to the extent that it's not a refundable credit. And so, whereas on the economics whiteboard, a tax credit and a subsidy are literally the same thing, in our political economy and in our legal framework, they are not at all. Even if the impact on the company's incentives and bottom line are exactly the same, saying, yep, here's how much tax you don't have to pay versus here's how big a check we will send you. I guess it's funny, in Washington, you want to avoid sending the check typically, but if the question is how do you actually do policy that is accountable for one thing and addresses who's getting it and how much it is, you kind of have to send the check if you want it to be in your little checkbook that it got sent out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Terrific. Well, we will look for more on that from you, Thomas Hochman, a research associate at the Foundation for American Innovation, a nuclear enthusiast like myself, though maybe a more realistic one. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We will be back with more on the American Compass podcast soon. Have a good day.